And now introducing Mr. Keith Lanton.
Hi, good morning. Today is Monday, July 31st. It is obviously the last day of the seventh month, and we will be beginning tomorrow into the month of August and be almost two-thirds of the way through 2023. So today, I'm going to speak about portfolio allocation and diversification. Specifically, I'm going to talk about allocation to bonds, also called fixed income, and what may be the appropriate percentage allocation for you in your portfolio as interest rates have changed meaningfully. Over the past few years, Federal Reserve, as we've been speaking about, has been on a campaign to eradicate or reduce inflation. It's taken the terminal rate on the Fed funds all the way up to 5.25% to 5.5%. Many of us, look back, and we have a recency bias, and we look back throughout most of our investing careers, perhaps depending on our ages, and in the past, we have been prone to being accustomed to interest rates on the Fed funds rate being at or close to zero, and fixed income investments paying very low returns. And that may have created a bias within our portfolios, albeit with perhaps rational reasoning, to traditionally underweight fixed income. And suggesting that, again, depending on your age and circumstances, that perhaps that is something that needs to be seriously revisited now that we have returned to, quote-unquote, more normal interest rates. And we'll talk about what that may implicate or mean for your portfolio and how you might want to strategize and rethink your fixed income allocation if you have drifted into the mindset that rates will be at or near zero for an extended period of time. Then what we're going to do is we're going to talk about a couple of Barron's articles that talked about bonds, in particular municipal bonds, which I know Brad will be speaking about. We'll review the morning's news, what's going on this week. Lots of earnings continuing to come in, as well as lots of economic reports. This is on the heels of last week when we got the Federal Reserve's decision to raise interest rates by an additional 25 basis points, widely expected. Financial markets digested that news quite well. We're pleased with the Federal Reserve's assessment. We saw equity markets improve last week. And then talk about Barron's and a couple of other articles they've got there. One on the House of Mouse, Disney, which was a article on why now may be a good time to start thinking about investing in Disney stock. And then we will also talk about country allocation, and specifically India as perhaps the next frontier, whether or not India is similar or not to China in the early 1990s and offers some good investment opportunity. So going to bring it all the way back to where we started, fixed income, also known as bonds. And fixed income and bonds often thought of as one of the central pillars to a portfolio. Traditionally, folks thought about what their equity allocation was and what their fixed income allocation would be, and that was largely how they thought about asset allocation. I would suggest that other asset classes now also fit into the mix, might be what people call alternative investments, which could include private credit, could also include REITs, real estate, could include precious metals or commodities in that allocation as well. And then with rates where they are today, certainly an allocation to cash would also be another asset class to consider. Now, when you're thinking about your asset allocation, that is probably one of, if not the largest drivers of your return in your account. More important than individual security selection is your asset allocation. And then within that asset allocation, the sector allocation. What do we mean by sector allocation? Well, if you're allocating to equities, we're talking about, well, what do you have in energy? What do you have in materials? What do you have in industrials, et cetera? And if you're investing in bonds, how are the bonds being invested? Are we talking about treasuries, agencies, municipals, certificates of deposit, high yield, investment-grade corporates? That decision of how much are you going to invest in an asset class and how much are you going to invest in a sector traditionally drives 90% of your returns. So the macro investment strategy is the investment strategy that will largely determine not only the performance of your portfolio, but also the volatility of your portfolio. And as we've discussed in the past, if your portfolio is too volatile and you are not good on roller coasters, you may say, you know what, Mr. Operator, get me off. Get me off this ride. I don't like it. Hit the kill switch. And you may jump off that roller coaster at the time when things are most volatile, which is typically when you're on that downswing of the roller coaster, when they can let you out. And typically you'll get out at that point, and then all of a sudden the roller coaster sometime in the near future will start climbing, and you'll say to yourself, you know what, I sold at level X, and now it's at X plus Y, and I'm going to wait for it to get to X minus Y. And very often it never gets to X minus Y, and you just watch the roller coaster climb back up because you couldn't stomach the volatility. And that's why bonds are very important to your portfolio. Bonds offer ballast to your portfolio. What does that mean? What is ballast? Ballast is a word that goes back to the time when ships were crossing the Atlantic. And what the ship operators would do is they would put weight or ballast into the hull of the ship, oftentimes in the form of bricks. That's how cities like New York and Boston got their cobblestone streets. All those stones would be put into the bottom of ships, and then when they got here in the New World, they would take those bricks out and fill those ships up with goods to send back to Europe. And that was ballast. But what did ballast do? What did that weight do? Well, that weight enabled the ship to be a lot less rocky, gave it a lot more opportunity for that ship to cross the Atlantic without capsizing. But what it also did is made the trip a little bit slower because the ship was heavier because of all those rocks. And you need to find the right balance to get to the right ballast for you so that you don't capsize, that you do make it across the ocean, the proverbial ocean here, and that you make it as fast as you possibly can, meaning getting the greatest returns that are possible for your portfolio at the same time, doing it at a speed that is comfortable for you. So now why are we talking about bonds here in mid-2023and ballast? Well, because for the first time in a long time, and this has been an ongoing trend, we are seeing real income from bonds so that they can provide real ballast to your portfolio. You may remember back in the height of COVID in March of 2020, the 10-year treasury, forget about the 1-year, the 2-year, the 6-month treasury, the 10-year treasury, 10 years, bottomed out at about 32 basis points. That's 0.32%. So if you were putting 10-year treasuries in your portfolio to give you ballast, meaning to give you some stability, they weren't adding a lot of weight. They were pretty much lightweight. And therefore, a lot of folks opted not to put those securities into their portfolio at that time because they weren't returning a lot. And the mentality is, you know what, let me sit in cash or let me sit in dividend-paying stocks and I'll get my income returns in that fashion. But here we are today, and we're looking at a Fed funds terminal rate of 5.25% to 5.5%. Looking at 3-year, 6-month treasuries in the neighborhood of 5.5%, the 1-year in the neighborhood of 5.35%, and the 2-year is at about a 4.85%, and the 10-year is almost 4%. So when rates on treasuries in the past have yielded close to nothing, the best you could hope for was a return of your principal. In other words, the best bonds could do was provide to you a return of your capital versus the stock market, which wasn't guaranteeing you ever a return of your capital. If you invested in bonds and they didn't default, you would get your capital back. But when you're looking at the potential for capital appreciation or return on your investment, well, that was mathematically very challenging when the rates were zero and the possibility of getting any appreciation in your bonds was due to rates getting more and more, not only zero, but negative, and that was a pretty unlikely event. So today, with the treasury yields being significantly higher, if you own individual bonds, even if interest rates fluctuate, you are going to get a return on your capital, whether that's 4% or 5% in the treasury market or arguably higher in other asset securities. Specifically, one that looks increasingly attractive are municipal bonds. Barron spoke about municipals. We'll talk about that article. Municipals look particularly attractive if you're looking at the short end of the curve where you're getting about 3%, and on the long end of the curve where you're getting close to 4% in the municipal bond market. So when you're taking a look at municipals, if you're in a high tax bracket, 3%, if you're in a 50% bracket, is 6%. 4% in a 50% bracket is 8%. So if you're thinking about your fixed income portfolio and you're in a high tax bracket, if you think to yourself, what is the likelihood that I am going to achieve equity returns of close to 8% over the next 30 years? And of course, that's factoring in the tax benefits of municipals. Municipals start to look increasingly attractive, especially if you don't think that this 4% rate on municipals is going to hold. In other words, that rates in the future may decline because the Federal Reserve will be successful in having raised interest rates and bringing down inflation. If the market believes that, then what's going to happen is eventually interest rates will start coming down and the ability to get 4% tax-free for 15 to 25 years will not be there anymore. So if you're thinking about stocks historically, they've returned about 10% annually. However, with the Fed funds rate now at almost 5.5%, which is debatably into restrictive territory, the potential for equity-like returns is diminishing, and the potential for equity-like returns in non-equity investments like municipal bonds is increasing. Today, the S&P 500 is trading at about 22 times earnings. What this means is that the average stock is earning about 4.5% versus its price. Now, what do I mean by that? What we do here is we take the inverse of a price-earnings ratio, which is price over earnings, and we flip it, and we do earnings divided by price. And if we do earnings divided by price, you take 1 divided by 22, you're coming up with a number about 4.5%, which is less than the 5.5% return you're getting in Fed funds. This is also known as the Fed model, something that the Fed looks at. And again, it's no precise guarantee of what the future may hold. But when the short-term interest rates are exceeding what's known as the earnings over price, it's sometimes viewed as a sign that equities relative to bonds may be more expensive than they traditionally are. And it may be an indication that perhaps you should think about what is your allocation to fixed income, what is your allocation to equities, and how should you be allocating within those different asset classes. Vanguard recently talked about fixed income in a piece called Bonds Are Back, saying that they view the higher yields on bonds as the ability for bonds to deliver positive returns, even in the face of continued rate hikes and periods of elevated volatility. They say the odds of a recession rise as rates go higher themselves, and they surmise in the end, we believe a shallow recession will occur. Bonds have traditionally done well after the Federal Reserve stops raising the Fed funds rate. And what they do is they give a analysis of how bonds have fared after the Fed has stopped raising rates, which, by the way, there's no guarantee that they have done that yet. You could make a case that they're getting closer to that than not. Given that we've gone from basically 0 to 5.5 on the Fed funds rate, it's arguably a reasonable point that we're closer to the end than the beginning. But nevertheless, we don't know where the end is. But when we have seen the Fed stop raising rates, the historical return on bonds since 1995, when the Fed has stopped raising rates, has been positive in each and every instance. If you go back to the 1995-1996 period, that saw the greatest increase in bonds, an increase of about 17%, and this is an aggregate composite of fixed income. And if you go back to the period of 2018-2019, we saw an average increase of about 6.5% after the Fed was done raising rates. BlackRock, which is also the backer and of the iShares, which you may have seen their ETFs, recently said yields are back and it may be time to rethink your allocation. Yields are back across all fixed income sectors with significant implications for advisors and their clients. Advisors and clients have an opportunity to rethink overall asset allocations. Sounds familiar. The opportunity in fixed income may be nothing short of profound, they say. After last year's relentless sell-off in bonds in 2022, yields are back across all fixed income sectors. And if you're looking at yields north of 4% in different sectors of the bond market, about 80% of the worldwide bond market is producing yields over 80%. The only portion of that 20% remaining are some European markets. And if you go back to 2013 to 2021, throughout that entire period, the only asset classes within fixed income returning north of 4% were emerging markets and high yield. So speaking about these fixed income opportunities, Barron's did an interview with the CEO of PIMCO, which is known for its bond expertise. And he said that they like several sectors or allocations within fixed income. One of their favorite sectors is mortgage-backed securities, which they say are very attractive as liquid assets that benefit from direct government guarantees at spreads as wide as they have seen since the 2008-2009 financial crisis. You're looking at mortgage-backed securities yielding anywhere between 5 and 5.5%, depending on the structure, with longer maturities versus long-term treasuries, which are yielding under 4%. If interest rates were to decline, typically mortgage-backed securities are more sensitive to declining interest rates because of the fact that the payment on some of the principal comes back quicker at 100 cents on the dollar. So you often get better returns in mortgage backs if you have a thesis that rates will be declining. Also, the CEO of PIMCO spoke very favorably about opportunities in shorter-term treasuries, which we talked about, those treasuries inside 2 years, yielding 5 to 5.5%, as well as in municipal bonds. And speaking about municipal bonds, Barron's this week wrote a column in their income investing column entitled Reasons to Fall in Love with Municipal Bonds Right Now, How to Invest. When a money market fund yields more than 5%, what's so special about municipal bonds yielding 3%? As it turns out, they say a lot. Take taxes into account and muni yields get much more appealing. And right now it's a good time to lock in longer term bonds. We talked about the effective municipal yield for people in high tax brackets. And Barron says that people who are in those high tax brackets are looking at a tax equivalent yield of about 8% if they were to use a bond ladder of longer term municipals. The locking in aspect is an important consideration, they say. Today's high rates on money market funds won't last forever, and investors who have flooded into them face reinvestment risk. When yields dip, the income generated by money market funds will fall, and the opportunity to invest in longer-term bonds, which rise in price when yields fall, will fade away. It isn't intuitive to add longer-term bonds when the Federal Reserve is raising rates, which it did again on Wednesday, but many strategists say the central bank is near the end of its rate hiking cycle, which means that rates could start to fall in the next year, creating opportunity for capital appreciation in bonds. Jim Murphy, who heads the municipal bond team at T. Rowe Price, said if you want to add duration, add it in munis. He says that's what he is doing in his own account. There's an important reason for that. The long end of the muni curve is where the most tax benefit in munis exists today relative to treasuries. And then finally, when you're talking about municipal bonds, if you're purchasing individual bonds, like many of our investors do, it also gives you the opportunity that if we're wrong and rates were to rise, it gives you the opportunity to do tax loss selling or tax loss harvesting, where you sell one bond, you buy a similar bond, your yield and income stay relatively stable, and you're able to recognize the tax loss. So if your timing is off, you can take advantage of a tax loss and maintain your allocation within that fixed income sector. So this morning, what's going on? Well, relatively quiet summer morning, at least at the outset so far. S&P futures right now are up about 6 points over fair value. NASDAQ futures are up about 35 points, and Dow futures are up about 45 points above fair value. Over the weekend, Minneapolis Fed Chair Neel Kashkari said in an interview he is no longer expecting a U.S. recession. China's manufacturing PMI remained in contraction in the July reading, while non-manufacturing PMI decelerated for the fourth consecutive month. Also, China said that they will launch new measures to increase consumption, but stop short of direct consumer report, according to Bloomberg. U.S. economic data today is limited to the July Chicago PMI. Last reading was at about 41.5. That comes out at 9:45. Taking a look at the Treasury market this morning, we are seeing the 2-year yield down about 1.5 basis points. It's at a 4.88. The 10-year down about 1 basis point at a 3.95. Other news, Wall Street Journal that reporting Congress is now in its August recess, but they will have to pass spending bills when they return in September. And New York Times is reporting that Ukrainian forces fired 3 drones at Moscow. Looking at markets overseas, equity indices in Asia-Pacific began the week on a higher note. And in Europe, we have a mixed performance with markets there trending higher, but a few relatively flat like the DAX and the FTSE. So coming up this week, we got a slew of earnings and a slew of economic data. Apple and Amazon are reporting this week, both on Thursday. In the U.S., we get manufacturing PMI out on Tuesday. We also, on Friday, get the very closely watched non-farm payrolls. Those are expected, and that's for July. Those are expected to increase by 200,000 jobs. Also, the unemployment rate is expected to stay stable at 3.6%. Report is also expected to show that average hourly earnings rose 0.3%. Also this week, we get factory orders. Those are expected to increase 1.9% in June. And we're going to get preliminary unit labor costs, which likely accelerated at a rate of 2.7%. Of course, all of these go into the inflation calculation. On Tuesday, we also get the jobs opening and labor turnover survey, again, giving us some insights into the labor market, or the JOLTS report. That's expected to show that job openings in June were down, but still very elevated. Other earnings this week, AMD, Qualcomm, Starbucks, Pfizer, Caterpillar, and Uber, to name a few, a couple others to name some more, Merck, Marriott, as well this week. So looking back on last week, we got that Fed decision, and we also got a lot of earnings. Barron's in their trader column said the earnings are everything, and most importantly, perhaps more than enough. Barron saying, forget the Fed, look past the data. There's just one thing that mattered to the market last week, and that was earnings. And in their opinion, they say they were darn good. Expect them to keep pushing stocks higher. Markets last week had a good week. S&P up 1%, Dow up 0.7%, NASDAQ up 0.2%. For some context, the S&P is now up 28% from its 52-week low reached on October 12th. And hit a new 52-week high on Friday. Then Barron's goes on to say that means it's bull market time. About half of companies have reported earnings. They're up about 3% from the previous year on average, which is lower than the 9% average in the second quarter of 2022, but it's better than anticipated. 80% of companies reporting better than expected earnings, which is better than last quarter and better than 1 year ago. Now, Barron's, I mentioned, wrote a favorable article on Disney, symbol DIS. Those who follow the stock know it has been a significant underperformer since peaking at just under $200 a share. The stock is down trading somewhere in the mid-80s, and Barron's feels that now is the time that investors should consider, as they feel that a recovery, albeit a slow one, is something that they feel is more likely than not. Once a favorite of growth investors, shares have tumbled nearly 60% from their highs. They have brought back Chairman Bob Iger, and he has made it clear that this is a whole new world for him as the second round of his CEO tenure. His contract was extended recently for 2 years until 2026, so he has time to implement his vision for the company, one that centers on two pillars, streaming and theme parks. Everything else, including Disney's cable channels, could be on the table for a possible sale. Disney is also taking steps to ensure that its earnings return to a more sustainable path. Even the dividend paused in 2020 could return by the end of the year. Barron saying, with its shares appearing cheap relative to earnings and the sum of its parts, now looks like the right time to bet on the magic returning, at least to Disney's stock. For now, the brightest spot in Disney's portfolio is the theme park, cruises, and consumer products businesses. Management says that per capita spending, per person spending at Disney's parks is 40% higher than it was in 2019. So what's the problem? Well, the problem is the media business. And the new CEO, or returning CEO, Bob Iger, is forced with the thorny problem of balancing its growth and figuring out what to do with its growing media streaming business. But at the same time, that growth has come at an expensive price. And at the same time, its linear business or sort of standard TV business is slowing as the company experiences higher churn and fewer subscribers. And what the company is doing to make up for that is they are increasing prices, which is then leading to a vicious cycle of more churn and fewer subscribers. So Mr. Iger has his work cut out for him. What he needs to do is return the streaming business to profitability, not merely subscriber growth. The company expects to have 135 to 165 million Disney Plus subscribers by the end of next year, and that's up from about 105 currently. At the moment, Mr. Iger is counting on that Disney is still a must-have for children of all ages, and there are reports that they are considering raising the advertising free tier of Disney, which costs currently about $11 a month, in order to supplement the streaming business. Also, it's widely expected that Disney will buy out the remaining portion of Hulu from Comcast and will deliver a bundle of Hulu, Disney Plus, and ESPN Plus into one aggregate product that will be the primary product that they offer. And the expectation is that this product potentially will have less churn and more pricing power than what they currently have. At the current time, Disney is also focusing on cutting costs, reducing 7,000 jobs, reducing content-related spending by about $2.5 billion. And all this adds up to the ability to hopefully turn the earnings around. And currently, Disney is trading at around 17 times 2024 projected earnings. And if you look at that versus the historical metrics, well, that's well below the five-year average of 29. Below the S&P 500's 21 or 22 times earnings, and a large discount to competitors like Netflix, which is trading around 30 times earnings, and only a slight discount to Paramount Global, which is trading around 16 times earnings, and arguably Disney, with all their different offerings, has a much more compelling proposition than Paramount, which trades at roughly a similar market multiple. A couple of other stories in Barron's, one about the drug makers. You may have noticed that the pharmaceutical sector has been a significant underperformer in 2023, and that is not for no good reason. It's because the government wants to impose pricing controls via Medicare on the pharmaceutical companies. But Barron's is suggesting in their article that the drug companies are pushing back against the Medicare pricing initiative, and Barron's says that they have a good chance, not a guaranteed chance, of success. What Barron's is suggesting is that the legal argument that the pharmaceutical companies are making, and there are several aspects to it, but perhaps the crux of their argument is that the Medicare price controls, let's call it, are a violation of the Fifth Amendment. And what the Fifth Amendment says is that property won't be taken for public use without just compensation. And this is known as the Takings Clause. And the pharmaceutical companies argue that the process laid out in the law is actually not a negotiation, but rather unilateral price setting, and that drug companies that opt out will face unreasonable financial penalty. Barron's goes on to say that they feel that the probability that the drug makers will have some success in pushing back against Medicare's suggested pricing caps or pricing power is that the pharmaceutical companies in federal court may win some ability to delay the implementation of Medicare's proposal, and that this decision ultimately may wind up at the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court will have to weigh in on whether or not the government can, through Medicare, dictate the prices that the way they are seeking to. Now, what the government is currently seeking to do is to negotiate, the pharmaceutical companies would put that in quotes, the price of the 10 largest spends on Medicare. And of these drugs, they are more heavily weighted to a couple of companies, and these companies are amongst the weaker performers. Specifically, Bristol-Myers and Pfizer arguably have the most to lose and potentially the most to gain if the government has any setbacks in their plans. And what Barron's is suggesting is that these stocks may have a favorable risk reward as some of the new information and the new rulings may be more favorable to the pharmaceutical industry. But the ultimate decision, they feel, is ultimately potentially going to be up to the Supreme Court. And we may not get a clear resolution for a number of years. Finally, before I turn things over to Brad, the last article in Barron's I will briefly discuss has to do with the country that they suggest perhaps may offer the fastest growth in 2024 and beyond, and that is India. India recently overtook China to become the world's most populous country, and Barron says the economy is booming after years of setback. A portfolio manager named Laura Gerritz, who runs the Rondor New World Fund, said, if I had one place in the world with the highest conviction in growth, India would be it. The question now is whether India can turn what Prime Minister Modi describes as India's decade into sustainable progress. For all the recent advances on a national level, companies still get bogged down in red tape at the local level. And while the middle class is growing rapidly and digitization has connected vast swaths of the population to banking, millions are left behind in poverty with the progress on education stalled in recent decades. Now, what Barron's suggests is that as folks move away from China for their manufacturing, that India has a tremendous opportunity, which is theirs to seize or to let go by the wayside, to take some of that manufacturing and bring it into India. And if India is successful at building out their infrastructure and bringing that manufacturing that is considering alternatives to China into India, then the next 10 years in India may look like China from 1991, with more broad-based growth, with growth coming from the lower classes as the lower classes get the opportunity to move up into the middle class. The long runway for growth is one reason that stocks in India may not be as pricey as the 19 times earnings that the market currently trades at. And what Barron's does is they list five different either ETFs or mutual funds that they say may offer a good experience and opportunity for those who are interested in investing in India. I'm going to turn it over to Brad to give some more insights on the markets.
Morning, Keith. Morning, everyone. I hope everyone had a great weekend. Keith, thanks for discussing the relevance of fixed income these days. I couldn't agree more with your take and comments on the sector. But even with the interest in bonds, both literally and figuratively, the last couple of weeks have really felt like the dog days of summer in the bond market. I don't know if it's the extreme heat, summer vacations, or maybe just everyone is set with what they already have for the time being. If it's the latter, that's great. Those of you who purchased municipal bonds late last year or early this year certainly are sitting pretty for now, and there's really nothing to do with those positions. However, for new and rollover money coming in, I still like the barbell approach for taxable accounts. I like short-term treasuries or agencies for the short end of the barbell, close to or at 5%. These treasuries and agencies are both state and local tax-exempt, even though they're federally taxable. So for high tax states, you still get some benefit there. I like that combined with longer-term municipals, which Keith had mentioned earlier, close to a 4% tax-free going out around 20 years or so. The rates are good here, and there isn't a lot of reason to be trickier than that. As always, stick with high-grade bonds. Also make sure you have good call protection here, because if the rate cycle changes and in a couple of years we're looking at lower rates again, you're going to be very unhappy that your 4% bonds have been called away. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it's a possibility. So look for at least 7 or 8 year call protection if you're buying these 4% bonds out there. There's absolutely no reason to play in the casino here. There are real rates and real products at the moment, and I don't think that anyone needs to get too clever. As the year progresses, and with the big move in the equity markets, let's please start to discuss tax loss swaps again for those low coupon bonds you may have not sold out last year. It's a great opportunity. Keith had mentioned this earlier. You can essentially trade an apple for an orange, and relatively speaking, maintain your position in the sector without changing too many things around. With that, I'll turn it back to Keith. Thanks.
Thanks, Brad. I want to reiterate one of the points that Brad made. I think it's important, especially if the thesis is that rates may go lower, like Brad said, nobody knows what the future will hold. But if you are going out longer in terms of maturity, it's worth getting only a little bit less yield to get the call protection, because if you're buying a long-term bond and it's callable, it very well may not be a long-term bond, and you may not enjoy the fact that you've locked in a good rate for a long period of time if it's able to be taken away from you in a short amount of time. And building on Brad's analogy with having the ability to swap municipal bonds at year end if you do have a loss, and not just municipals but any bond, it may even be better than swapping an apple for an orange. In many cases, you can swap a Macintosh apple for a Gala apple. I mean, the bonds can be very similar, not identical, but very similar, in order to enjoy a tax loss and to keep your portfolio largely intact the way it was before making that action. So some real advantages. That's everything I've got.
Thank you for listening to Mr. Keith Lanton. This podcast is available on most platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Pandora. For more information, please visit our website at www.heraldlantern.com.
Opinions expressed herein are subject to change and not necessarily the opinion of the firm. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The information presented herein is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide personal investment advice. It is important that you consider your tolerance for risk and investment goals when making investment decisions. Investing in securities does involve risk and the potential of losing money. The material does not constitute research, investment advice, or trade recommendations.